This is Where We Live.
Do you ever think about where your trash goes after you throw it out?
Never really thought of it.
To the dump?
Yeah, local landfill.
So we think that it goes to landfills and stays there indefinitely.
Yeah, landfill.
In Bristol, I know our trash gets incinerated.
To a landfill.
It gets decomposed.
I would say it probably gets burned at some point.
I would assume that it's probably processed somewhere in the Hartford area.
I have this vision of the trash going all in one place. The recycling, the trash, anything that is tossed away, all going to a big landfill and being burned somewhere, then shipped to the moon or to Columbia or somewhere where nobody has to see it anymore.
Those are voices gathered in West Hartford Center by our intern, Katie Pikus. I'm John Dankosky. Today, Where We Live, we are talking about trash. As you've just heard, it's not exactly clear to everyone where the stuff you throw away goes. But what you do know is that when it goes away, it's someone else's problem. But ask Adam Minter. His book, Junkyard Planet, shows that it's not often someone else's problem, but rather their opportunity. His book explores the multi-billion-dollar scrap industry, from tons of tangles of Christmas lights to the many, many hands of workers in China and India who sort through the stuff we used to own as a way to make their living. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Later, we'll talk to a reporter who helps us find where those bags of old clothes go after we dump them in those white bins in the grocery store parking lot. And we'll also talk to a NASA scientist who studies the trash that is orbiting our planet. But first, let me welcome in Adam Minter. He's a columnist for Bloomberg View, and he's author of Junkyard Planet. He joins us from Malaysia on the phone today. Adam Minter, welcome to Where We Live.
Oh, it's such a pleasure.
So first of all, we talk about a multi-billion dollar trade. I think a lot of people, like the people we asked in the street, just think that the garbage we throw away goes someplace, it gets burned, but an awful lot of the stuff gets reused, which is what you write about. Maybe you can just set this up for us and tell us, how big is this scrap industry that you traced around the planet?
Sure. Well, the best estimate that we've got right now is it's worth somewhere in the range of about $500 billion of turnover a year. That's roughly equivalent to the amount of money that flows through the Norwegian economy. It's very, very large. And I think one of the reasons that people tend not to think of it as a big business, as a real money-making opportunity, is quite simply, at least in developed countries like the United States, it's just something that you throw away. You don't think of it as being worth money. But if you actually spend time in this industry, what you quickly learn is that it's actually a commodity, that it's the scrap trade in a sense, the recycling trade in a sense, competes directly with iron ore miners. It competes with, you know, virgin paper companies. It competes with plastic companies. It's a raw material, and it is really an either-or proposition. I mean, just to give you a sense of why this is so big, copper, you know, which is the essential metal to everything we do, you know, the iPhone I'm talking to you on, the power that's flowing into your studio, roughly half the global supply of copper comes from recycled material. Most people don't realize that. When I saw that, I came across those figures, I was astounded. But if you think about it as being an essential metal and half the world supply comes from recycled resources, you get a sense of just how big this industry is and how important it is to the global economy.
And in a bit, I want to get into some of the specifics about copper recycling and these things that we don't think about. Here in the U.S., here's what we do think about. A lot of us have single stream recycling now, and this is a big deal. You know, we've got the blue bin that goes outside on the curb. And what we can do is put our newspapers in it, maybe our cans, our bottles, and that's about it. And we understand, I think, at some level that all of those things get made into something else. The box we buy later is made from recycled paper, or maybe the fleece sweatshirt that we buy is made, we know, from the little fibers that come off of the plastic bottles. But it goes so far beyond just those three key things that we throw away.
Right. Well, you know, here's how I think of recycling, having spent, you know, years around it. You know, you can think of it as what you put into your bin, but you ultimately have to think about it in terms of where it goes. If nobody wants to make stuff out of what you throw away, it's not going to be recycled. I mean, the act of putting something in the blue bin really isn't the act of recycling. That's the act of harvesting for the person who's going to recycle. Right now, the United States recycles. That is, it reuses or refurbishes about two-thirds of what ends up in the proverbial recycling bin. That may be the blue bin, you know, you have there in Connecticut. It may be a big green Gaylord box at a manufacturer somewhere in Hartford. But about two-thirds of that stuff will stay in the United States because the United States manufactures a lot of stuff. The other third of it will go overseas because the U.S. doesn't have enough manufacturing capacity to handle it. There's any range of uses. I mean, I'm often asked, you know, what happens to this product? What happens to that? I mean, I've been to factories in China where PET bottles, your Evian bottles, your Coke bottles, are turned into new carpeting for homes across China. You know, I've been in paper mills in India that are making boxes for shoes that are going to Europe. I mean, the range of possible uses is endless. But this myth that's out there that what goes in your recycling bin gets actually tossed into a landfill is, in general, completely false, because this stuff is worth just so much money, and it's worth money because it's useful.
And it's useful to people, and this idea that it's useful to people overseas is so interesting. So much of what we consume here in America is manufactured overseas, and it's shipped in plastic containers. And what you're tracing is this world in which things are made halfway around the world, and they're shipped all the way here to the U.S. We use them for a while, and then we throw them out, and then they're packaged up and sometimes torn up and baled up and then shipped back overseas for someone else to use once again.
Well, that's just it. I mean, you know, when people tell me that they, you know, they're really troubled by the fact that the recycling goes overseas, I tell them there's a very simple solution to this. Stop buying so many products from overseas. Now, that's a little bit snarky. It's, you know, easier said than done, but that's precisely what it is. If you want to understand recycling, you have to understand where your stuff is made. And increasingly, more and more of our stuff is made overseas. And what that does is it creates an opportunity for the logistics industry. Now, I know that word logistics puts a lot of people asleep, but let me explain this really simply. Right now, if you want to send a container of goods, a shipping container, we all know what those look like, from Los Angeles to South China, it'll cost you roughly $600. If you want to go back in the other direction from Shenzhen, where so much stuff is made and there's so much competition to send containers to the United States, if you want to send that same container from Shenzhen back to Los Angeles, it's going to cost you in the range of $3,000. So to go from L.A. back to Shenzhen, because the U.S. really doesn't have that much to send to China, it's only about 20% of the value. And that's a huge incentive then to send our stuff, our garbage, whatever you want to call it, back overseas. You know, if Americans stop buying so much stuff and it becomes more and more expensive to send those containers back to China, then, you know, you're going to have a disincentive to do it. And some of that material is going to stay here. But the bitter irony is, if that material, those old newspapers, stay here, the U.S. just doesn't have the manufacturing capacity to use them at this point. So a lot of that stuff will get landfilled. And that's happened before, where the price of recyclables has dropped to a point where the Chinese don't want it because the demand isn't there, because Americans don't want to buy stuff from them. And as a result, recyclables will end up in landfills because there's no economic value to them.
We're talking with Adam Minter. He is the author of a fascinating book called Junkyard Planet. We're talking about trash and where it goes today. If you have questions about this world, you can call us at 860-275-7266. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. You have a very personal family connection to this story. Tell us about your family's history and why it got you so interested in the scrap business.
Sure. Well, my great-grandfather, when he came to the United States in the early 20th century, he came from Russia, penniless peasant. He wanted to be a song and dance man, a vaudevillian, and unfortunately he ended up in Galveston, where there weren't many opportunities for that. So lacking a stage, he did the only thing he could do, which was start picking up trash, garbage, you know, what most people thought of as garbage from the streets. In his case, it was rags, cloths, you know, old clothes, and selling them for recycling. They were made into paper. And over time, you know, he got himself a backpack, then he got himself a truck, and he made his way up to Minneapolis and started a scrap business that was mostly focused on metals. And I grew up around a junkyard. I like to say I was born in a junkyard. That's not entirely accurate, but but I grew up around this world. And, you know, in my 20s, when I decided not got to be a part of it, I moved on to journalism, I still maintained an interest in it. And that interest and the fact that I'd grown up around this very unique culture actually gave me the opportunity when I moved to China about 12 years ago to actually start spending time in Chinese junkyards, which struck me as, roughly the same culturally. So that's basically my story, is I have deep sort of genetic roots to this industry, and that's been helpful in being able to explore some of the more interesting and more difficult to access corners of it, whether that be, in Northwest India or China or Brazil or, the scrapyards of the United States.
Yeah, in many ways, your story is typical of the story of all of those that you study. In your book, you ask this question, so how do people go from grubbing to running actual scrap businesses? People who have better options, you're right, don't generally choose to spend their time sorting through other people's garbage. Essentially, what you're writing, Adam, is that both your family story and the stories of all these people in China and in India and other far-flung places around the world, they're in this business because it is a way for them to make money off the stuff that we throw away, and we just don't pay as much attention to what big business it is.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I call it in the book, in Junkyard Planet, I call it the entrepreneurial opportunity of last resort. If you have a good education, if you have other opportunities, you're probably not going to want to spend time digging through other people's throwaways. But if you don't have other opportunities, this is a very, very good opportunity. It's a cash business, and it's dragged millions of people, millions of families into their respective middle classes. It was my family, my great-grandfather. He was able to make his way up to Minneapolis, own property, put kids through college, and I've seen people of very, very limited means starting out in China, in India, in Brazil, around the developing world, do the same thing. It's a great opportunity, and it's a very, very large business. It's also changing because, as we all know, the world is not exactly running out of raw materials, but they are becoming more scarce. I mean, if you go to a fuel pump and you buy gas, you're competing for that gas against somebody in China because, gas is what, I don't know what it is in Connecticut, but it's over $3 a gallon at this point. We are entering a period of resource scarcity, and as a result of that, there's, good environmental reasons to recycle, but there's, you could say, just as good of economic reasons because the price of everything is going up. And as a result of that, you still have this small entrepreneurial class, but you also have scrap metal companies, scrap paper companies, scrap plastic companies that are actually becoming large conglomerates, and you can even buy stock on them on the major indices around the world.
We're going to take some phone calls now. I can report to you, Adam, that gas here in Connecticut is very, very expensive. Let's go to Andy, who is calling from Hamden. Hi there, Andy. Go ahead.
Hey, how are you? Pleasure and really refreshing to hear some of the comments regarding this, Adam, and thank you. We're actually come from a very similar background where my family's been doing refuse and recycling in our area for 50 years. Not from the scrap metal perspective, but a lot from the plastic, paper, and fiber. Over the years, it's always been said, one man's trash is another man's treasure or gold. And it's true to be said that it's coming to light now as Europe demands more of our recycled recovered material. Rest assured, very much of that blue bin recycling that we do here in Connecticut does go for recovery and more on the rise each day, because by production, what we produce in packaging alone is probably in excess of 70. And I'm guessing these are not factual numbers. This is my guess just by my physical well-being. I'm seeing it. We've been in the business forever, and what we pick up today, I truly believe in the next generation will recover a larger magnitude of it, and our recovery rates will go well beyond 50% as we have the ability to put them through systems that are being developed today, automated systems of recovery. We have a plant in Hartford that does just that, and I just hope that as we shift gears in the waste industry in our state, we led the nation in the trash to energy. And now I truly believe it's material recovery and processing first that or less as we compost and remove that wet waste. What's left is primarily dry, and it's recoverable, and it's actually able to be separated and source separated. That way, well, we really do have the ability to recover all of our waste and send it abroad.
Well, first of all, Andy, thank you so much for your phone call, and I appreciate your expertise on this, having been in the business for such a long time. And I wanted to put one of your thoughts to Adam Minter. He talks about a future that he sees, Adam, in which we're able to recover even more and more through technological means. One of the things you write about in your book, of course, is overseas, yes, there's high technology being used to process a lot of this material that we send over there, but there's also just a lot of hands. More people working in this business than almost any other business in the entire world, people having to sort through the stuff. So Andy says here in the United States, technology will help us recover even more. Do you see that future, maybe even going overseas?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's a very interesting point. I mean, one of the kind of the curious ironies that you find if you report on this industry relates to recycling rates. You know, how much of a given country's or place's trash stream is actually recycled, that can be recycled. If you go to China, my old neighborhood in China, in Shanghai, I can assure you that the recycling rate was upwards of 99%. If there was something to be pulled out of the trash, there were people literally scrounging through it at night behind my apartment building, pulling it out, that last can, that last newspaper. You know, in the United States, if, you know, a city that can get itself to a 60% recycling rate is proud. Why can't, you know, cities in the United States go up to a 99% rate? Well, quite simply, the technology isn't there to do what a pair of human hands can do. And as a result, even a city like San Francisco, which has, you know, a recycling rate very high, probably in the range of about 60%, you know, you put it up against Shanghai, they just can't compare. So we do need to rely on that technology. And I describe in Junkyard Planet some of these systems that are coming online. The technologies are getting better and better, and the economic incentives are there to make them better and better. Just one last thing, you know, I think it's really important to tell people, too, you know, we talk a lot about the blue bin and home recycling, and it's very important to all of us because we have a very personal connection to it, but it's always important to remember that in the United States, of the stuff that's recycled, only about 10% of it comes out of the home. The other 90% of the stuff is coming out of businesses, coming out of farms, coming out of utilities. Home recycling is really just a very, very small part overall of what's recycled in the United States.
I want to get one more phone call before our break. Mike is calling from West Hartford. Hi there, Mike. You're on with Adam Minter.
Oh, boy. Adam. But I heard about the show, and I was waiting to hear it. I'm glad you were called. Let me talk.
Absolutely. What's on your mind, Mike?
Yeah, sure.
I am a registered piano technician. I'm a piano tuner, and I am probably one of the only people in my trade who has actually written an article in my trade journal describing the values of scrap metal that comes out of a piano.
Ah.
Fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
So Mike, you see a lot of metal coming out of pianos. We don't think about them because we don't see the insides the way you do. What's the value in there, Mike?
Well, gentlemen, I slice them up like salami. But for example, there's a part in it that some people call a harp, but actually is called a cast iron plate. And in the piano, I've scrapped pianos that the plate can be 120 pounds to 220 pounds and even heavier. And it's not true cast iron because true cast iron will shatter with a sledgehammer blow. Now that metal is classified heavy metal and actually fetches a fair price at a scrapyard. Piano strings, screws, all ferrous hardware will probably be classified as light metal, which you will be paid less. Now, there is copper in pianos, kids, and this copper is wound around the bass strings of a piano. And if you don't know where that is, if you're sitting in a piano, the left side of you will have bass strings. And those bass strings have copper windings of graduated dimension.
Yeah.
Now, it's a bear getting this copper off. It takes me about an hour and a half to 2 hours to get this copper off, which, by the way, is classified as number one copper.
Mike, I'm going to break in and just ask you a quick question before we got to take a break, but do you have a sense of how much money you can get out of scrapping a piano? I mean, do you have a dollar figure on it?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
The most I ever got out of a piano was $38 and change for 6 hours' work.
That's not bad. I mean,
not bad at all.
At a Minter, and Mike, that's a great story. Thank you very much for that. We never thought about scrapping pianos. We're thinking about other stuff. But Adam, does that sound about right? There's a lot of metal that you can use inside a piano. You just have to work really hard, like Mike does, slicing it up like salami.
Yeah, you just have to work really hard, and I love stories like that. And I mean, it's amazing to me. Everything is recyclable, and in my travels, I've come across recycling facilities that have just utterly shocked me. I mean, I could give you stories. Probably my favorite one was in Japan, right at the base of Mount Fuji. I came across a pachinko recycling facility. If you know what a pachinko machine is, essentially a Japanese slot machine. It was a giant facility devoted to recycling pachinko machines. There's so many stories you can tell like that. And it's all an instance of somebody figuring out the most efficient way to extract the raw material, that thing that can be made into something else from a resource. It's a lot of fun to look into.
When we come back from a break, we'll talk a little bit about all those Christmas lights, the ones that get tangled in your attic. Yeah, Adam Minter's got a great story about where those go. And we're also going to talk to Elizabeth Klein. She's a reporter who takes a look at what happens to all the clothes we throw in those white bins, the ones in the grocery store parking lot. Where do those clothes go? You can join us, 860-275-7266. We're talking trash, where we live. If you don't know what I'm doing, what you know is trash. We'll pick it up, take them lights away. Trash, we'll get it up. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, we're talking about the stuff we throw away, trash. The book Junkyard Planet by Adam Minter takes a very close look at where a lot of the stuff that we discard here in the U.S., where it goes and how many billions people are making off of that trash. We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266, and we'll get back to Adam in just a moment. But I want to bring in to the conversation Elizabeth Klein. She's a New York-based journalist and author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. She wrote a piece for The Atlantic called Where Does Discarded Clothing Go? Writing about those boxes, the ones we have in a lot of parking lots at the grocery store, the white boxes where you throw your stuff and sometimes people put old mattresses outside. Well, all that stuff goes somewhere, and Elizabeth tried to find out exactly where. Welcome to Where We Live, Elizabeth.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So, first of all, why did you get interested in this? Why did you start studying what was happening with these boxes in New York City?
Well, in New York, we've recently had a problem with a nonprofit textile recycler placing bins on public sidewalks, which in New York City is a violation. It's against the law, and a lot of people were up in arms about it. But what I found interesting was what was really, really ticking people off was they found out that the clothes they were placing inside these illegal bins weren't going to charity. They were going to a for-profit textile recycler. So I was really intrigued. Why, why is clothing this one last bastion of trash that we are so particular about what happens to it? We don't care what happens to our plastic bottles. We don't care what happens to our newspapers after we cast them off. Yet we have this particular emotional attachment to what happens to clothes. So that's sort of how I started to dig into what exactly was happening once we put them inside the bins.
Hey, now, before we get into some of what you found, why do you think, as someone who's written about the fashion industry and the fact that we do in America buy an awful lot of cheap stuff that frankly shouldn't mean that much to us, why do you think we have this emotional attachment to where our clothing goes?
I think it has to do with the fact that charities have been our de facto textile recyclers for 100 years, and the system is just outdated and outmoded, and there's a lot of public misinformation about it. We don't understand that textiles are over 95% recyclable. Even stained, torn, ripped clothes, socks, underwear, bras, everything is virtually recyclable. And I think part of the reason that is a lot of cities don't want to get involved in textile recycling because it's expensive, and there's already a private system in place to deal with it. So they kind of benefit from the charities kind of ruling this world, the charities and nonprofit textile recyclers ruling this world, when really I think it's time for cities to get more involved and take more action in this area, just as they've done with plastic and paper over the past several decades.
So in New York, there was this one company that drew a lot of attention and a lot of ire. But all over Connecticut, all over our listening area, in New York and on Long Island and Massachusetts, you find these boxes. Can you tell us anything, Elizabeth, about how someone might know when they approach one of these boxes with, you know, a bag full of sweaters that at one point meant something to them, whether or not they're going to go to a nonprofit charity in which they will end up on someone's back, or they'll go to a for-profit and be ground up somewhere, or whether or not they're just going to go in the garbage someplace? I mean, how might someone actually know where their stuff's going?
They're not going to go into the garbage. And usually a, you know, I would say most of the recyclers and charities in this space play by the rules. So if it says on the side of the box, this is for charity, then it's for charity. If it says this is a for-profit recycler, then it's for a for-profit recycler. But what is confusing, I think, for a lot of people is that even if you're donating clothing to charity, a lot of times it's going to end up being sold downstream to a textile recycler or a textile grader, and they use that money to fund their charitable programs. And that's been the case really going back to, you know, the 1940s, charities shops like Goodwill or Salvation Army, they simply received too many clothing donations. I mean, you know, think about it. Americans buy so much clothing. We buy five times the amount of clothing we bought in 1980. Charities just simply cannot resell everything we donate to them in their charity shops. So what they do is they bail up what they can't put in the retail shops, sell it to textile recyclers, they sell it to these for-profit companies, and then they use that money to fund their charitable programs. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. The way consumers have to start thinking about this is textiles, we have a textile waste crisis in the United States, and any organization that is legitimately trying to find a place for the reuse or recycle of clothing is doing a good thing.
But this is what's so fascinating about this, as we talked to Elizabeth Klein, who's written Where Does Discarded Clothing Go for The Atlantic. She's also the author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. One of the things that's amazing is you're describing this cycle of consumerism that's so baffling, that we have a waste crisis because we buy so much stuff. And then half the stuff gets ground down and gets made into more stuff that we then buy. And some of it goes onto shelves, which we then buy at a lower cost. I mean, it must just make your head spin thinking about this cycle that we just don't seem to be able to break, Elizabeth.
Well, I mean, I think that product life cycles all across the board, whether you're talking about electronics, furniture, most consumer goods are caught in what is essentially a fast fashion cycle. We consume more than we ever have before, and products kind of turn over quicker, and we're always being offered the latest and the newest thing. And I think that that's part of why, especially in the fashion industry, some companies are starting to look at using upcycled and recycled materials in new products. You know, that's a whole other part of this conversation, is how do we move away from using raw materials every time we create something new? And, you know, that's why you see Nike and Adidas, for example, a lot of the athletic apparel companies are starting to use recycled polyester in their clothing lines, and hopefully that's something else that we'll see in the years to come. And I know that H&M has already started a in-store recycling program where you can bring clothing back to the store. Eileen Fisher has one, North Face has one, Patagonia has one, and I believe Patagonia actually upcycles the returned clothing into new products, which I think is fantastic.
Well, and it's just that it's a fascinating marketing idea, too. You know, bring the stuff back and then you can shop and buy some more stuff. anything to get people back into the stores. I'd love to actually get a thought here from Adam Minter, who wrote Junkyard Planet, especially, Adam, this idea that sparked Elizabeth's column, that people are upset that the clothing that's getting thrown away is going to some, you know, evil for-profit company as opposed to a nonprofit, whereas indeed, as she suggests, there is this problem out there of too much stuff. Someone's taking care of it. In your mind, Adam, is it a big deal that the clothing that goes in these bins might not actually be going to a not-for-profit charitable organization?
No, not at all. In fact, it's funny. Just a couple weeks ago, I was in Austin, Texas, visiting a Goodwill facility there, Goodwill Central Texas, and they take care of Central Texas, which is Austin, essentially. And when I was in their facility, they told me that they were shipping out every day 10 trailer loads of used clothing, and that's just Central Texas. Now, there aren't enough people in the United States or anywhere to take on all that clothing. Some of that clothing, I saw it, you know, wasn't wearable. So something needs to be done with it, and it was going to be ground up and used in other products. I mean, at a certain point, the consumer is going to need to take responsibility for this. But ultimately, I think it's incumbent upon producers to start doing a better job of, one, informing people of what their consumption actually entails, and two, doing a better job of is just as Elizabeth said, upcycling. Now, there are limits to upcycling. I mean, we all have it in our mind that if we, recycle a product, it's going to green heaven and it's magically going to be turned into something else and there'll be no carbon emissions or anything like that. But that's not true. Every time you recycle something, you lose a little bit of it. I was with a plastics recycling facility recently, and plastics recycling is incredibly difficult. You can't really upcycle plastics. If you recycle plastics, you can take the recycled plastics, they're going to break down partly, so you need to mix new plastics in. So even when you get something that says, made from 20% post-consumer plastics, the reason it's 20% is if it was 100%, it'd be too brittle and it would fall apart. So again, this comes down to, the old pyramid we've all thought about before: reduce, reuse, recycle. I like to put at the top of that pyramid, add something else, repair. Before you start reducing your consumption, repair what you have, if you want to think about this in environmental terms.
Well, and Elizabeth, before I let you go, I'm wondering if you see any other trends in this world. Obviously, repair is one of them, but the clothing industry doesn't really like that, right? They don't want us to keep our stuff forever and keep repairing it. They want us to cycle through and buy new things all the time. Do you think that there's some sort of a moment of clarity that comes in the clothing industry sometime soon that just says, look, we need to change our practices substantially, not just in this sort of upcycling way that you described, but something completely new here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say, my book came out in the summer of 2012, and I couldn't have imagined some of the changes that have happened. I think a lot of it, basically, I think we're seeing fast fashion fatigue, and a lot of that started with the recession, people looking at their closets and being like, I own hundreds of items of clothing and I feel like I have nothing to wear, or it's all falling apart. And I think the kind of like cheap thrill of fast fashion is wearing on some people. And there are a lot of new independent fashion companies coming out, so-called slow fashion companies, that are focused on making better quality, more sort of classic pieces. The thing is, fast fashion companies are moving into the Chinese market, for example, and they're moving into new markets overseas. So that's the real danger right now, is even if American consumers kind of pull back and have had their moment of clarity, what do we do about what's happening on the other side of the world as new consumers are drawn into this system? It's scary stuff, and it's something that we all need to assess and think about as a culture.
Elizabeth Klein is a New York-based journalist and author of Overdressed, The Shockingly High Cost of Cheap Fashion. She wrote about where discarded clothing goes for The Atlantic recently. Elizabeth, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to get to one quick phone call here. Marie is in Ashford. Hi, Maria.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
I always ask myself where all that clothes that goes in the bins is for charity. But that's good. But now I know that in my old country, every week they arrive the bunch of clothes, and they've been sold to the people very cheap. And they have two qualities. The good clothes, it's like a boutique. And the regular T-shirt and shoes, sweaters, and et cetera, they sell it very cheap. And, of course, the people that bring the clothes to the other countries, that they have to pay here. And I understand that's what a charity money goes.
Maria, thank you so much for your phone call. Your home country, I understand, is Guatemala, and we've heard these stories, told these stories on our air before about how some of our stuff that maybe doesn't get sold ends up in many, many countries around the world being sold very cheaply. Adam Minter, we just have about a minute and a half left, and I want you to tell the story about what happens to our Christmas lights. You know, the ones that get tangled up in our attic and we can't get rid of? Where do those go, and who makes money off them?
Well, they ultimately, almost all of them go to China, and a very large portion of them, 20 million pounds a year approximately, go to a place called Shijiazhuang, which is in southern China, where a very simple technology, brilliant technology, is used to chop them up, and they use water, basically gravity, to float the heavy parts to the insulation to the top of a pool of water and the copper to the bottom. They separate them out. The plastic insulation is sold to plastic recyclers. The one that I described at the beginning of Junkyard Planet, those are actually made into slipper soles, and the copper can be made into just about anything, but in many cases, it's made into new Christmas tree lights that are then promptly shipped back to the United States. It's sort of a perfect example of the closed loop recycling, though not necessarily the one that a lot of us had in mind when that term first came up.
You know, when we had our call from our piano tuner who breaks down old pianos, he said maybe he can get $38 out of a piano. I mean, how much money is coming out of a string of Christmas lights that I might pay a couple bucks for?
Well, it all depends what the price of copper is at any given time. The average Christmas tree light strand is 28% copper. Copper right now, you know, I have to admit I haven't looked at the price in a while, but let's just say it's about $3.10 a pound. So there you go. And, of course, you're not going to get paid the $3.10 because that would be the market price for the copper. You're going to get paid some kind of discount, which, you know, accounts for the amount of money it costs to ship it to China and the processing. But that gives you a rough idea. The insulation is priced by the ton, so it's quite minuscule. The reason it goes to China, though, is because, one, nobody in the U.S. is making Christmas tree lights anymore. Two, the United States has more copper than it can use.
Well, and we have more Christmas tree lights, seemingly, than we even have Christmas trees. Adam Minter, it's a fascinating book, and it's a really weird world that you've uncovered in Junkyard Planet. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
We've been talking about terrestrial trash. We're going to go into outer space next, where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, you've probably gotten one of these legislative reports from your elected representatives. These mailers tout their accomplishments. Sometimes they criticize political opponents. But they're not paid for with campaign money. This constituent outreach is actually paid for with public dollars. We'll look at the history of this practice called franking at the state and federal level, and you can join our conversation coming up on the next Where We Live. Sometimes, of course, those mailers end up in the trash. And today we've been talking about trash, how sometimes it goes from our house halfway around the world for someone else to use. But you know where else there's a lot of trash? Orbiting around our world. Space debris was the main plot point of the hit movie Gravity from last year.
Houston, elaborate.
Debris from the missile strike has caused a chain reaction, hitting other satellites and creating new debris. Traveling faster than a high-speed bullet up towards your altitude. Now copy.
Copy all.
Faster than a high-speed bullet. Our student journalist from the podcast Blue Mike Radio wanted to learn more about what is orbiting around up there and what dangers it actually could cause. Here's Grady Montalvo, a now graduated senior from Hartford's Journalism and Media Academy and a founding member of Blue Mike Radio, talking to J.C. Liu, chief scientist at the NASA Orbital Debris Program Office.
What is orbital debris?
The term orbital debris is used to describe any human-made object in Earth's orbit which no longer serves any useful purpose. Examples of orbital debris, including launch vehicle upper stages, retired spacecraft, mm-hmm. and fragmentation debris. Fragmentation debris are breakup fragments generated from explosion or collisions involving upper stages or spacecraft. Orbital debris is a serious problem. It is a byproduct of the human space activities, since 1957. And so we need to look at this orbit debris as a pollution to the environment. Therefore, no, it is really our responsibility to try to do a better job, not only to manage the environment to mitigate the problem, but try to find a way to make the environment better in the future. So I think that's something that we all need to recognize and do a better job to preserve the environment for future generations.
How much debris is currently orbiting?
Ah, good question. In terms of mass, the amount of material, the amount of orbit debris in space is about 6,300 metric tons.
Wow.
And of the 6,300 metric tons of material in space, about 2,700 tons of the material is concentrated in the low Earth orbit. The low Earth orbit is the region below 2,000 kilometers altitude.
Wow.
And in terms of number, the largest orbit debris, they are being tracked by the Air Force. So the Air Force right now, they are tracking about 23,000 objects. And these track objects, they are approximately 4 inches and larger. So about 10 centimeters all the way to 10 meters for big rocket bodies or spacecraft. So that's just for the big 10 centimeter and larger orbital debris. And we do have additional ground-based radar data which indicate that when you go down to about 1 centimeter in size, the orbital debris population is about 500,000. And just because they are small doesn't mean they are not problems for operational spacecraft. Because, for example, the typical impact speed in space in low Earth orbit is about 10 kilometers per second. And when you have such high impact speed, 10 kilometers per second, even debris as small as 0.2 millimeter could be a problem for human spaceflight and for robotic missions.
Have you seen the movie Gravity?
Yes, I have.
So you probably know what I'm about to ask you. How does that relate? Did you think with the information that they portray was accurate with what's going on right now with orbital debris?
Right. No, the movie is very good because it increases the public awareness of the orbital debris problem. And of course, it's just a movie, so some of the physics may not be quite right as portrayed in the movie. And one example is that the Kessler syndrome. I don't know if you have heard of this term, Kessler syndrome.
No, not at all.
Okay, it means collision cascade effect, meaning that once collisions, accidental collisions among orbiting objects start to occur, fragments generated from those collisions will induce more collisions down the road. So the entire environment will snowball into the future. So you have a collision cascade effect.
Mm-hmm.
And this was predicted by a pioneer orbital debris scientist, Don Kessler, who studied the entire orbital debris research as the NASA chief scientist back in the 60s and 70s at Johnson Space Center. So that is a collision cascade effect. But now for something like a collision cascade, Kessler syndrome to happen, it will take a long, long time. But in the movie, you can see it almost happens over the course of several days, which is, again, just not realistic. It's not about the physics. It's about the awareness of this orbital debris problem.
Can you explain what the International Space Station is? Is there any danger to the International Space Station from orbital debris?
Yes. Well, International Space Station is a collaboration of several international space countries, and it's a wonderful national laboratory for many experiments that we could conduct and then use the result to pave the way for future exploration missions to, for example, to go back to the moon or go to Mars or go to nearest asteroids. So, you know, International Space Station is a very important and critical asset for NASA and for United States. Now, of course, the International Space Station is subjected to impacts from orbital debris all the time.
Yes.
But the International Space Stations have impact shields designed and built to protect the stations from impacts of orbital debris of certain sizes. For example, if you look at the U.S. modules on the space station, they have very good protection shields, meaning that they are protected against orbital debris about 1.4 centimeter and smaller. So anything smaller than 1.4 centimeter, when they hit the U.S. modules of the International Space Station, the particles will not penetrate the module. So we are protected. But if the International Space Station is hit by something bigger, then there is a problem.
We have read that there are many initiatives to clean up space junk, including a space fence built by the Air Force. What is NASA doing to clean up or cut down on debris?
Now, the Air Force space fence is really just ground-based sensors, telescope and radar to monitor the orbital debris. So it is not really a defense against orbital debris. It's just a sensor to monitor, to track orbital debris. Now, in terms of removing orbital debris from the environment, the White House released a national space policy in the year 2010. And in that national space policy, the statement is very clear. It directs NASA and Department of Defense to pursue research and develop technology and techniques for orbital debris removal. But it's very difficult, it's very challenging, and it will be very, very expensive.
All right. What's a typical day like for you at NASA?
Yes. I am a member of the NASA Orbital Debris Program Office, and we conduct orbital debris research covering all aspects of orbital debris from measurements, modelings, to hypervelocity impact testing and protection and mitigation guidelines and policy development. So for measurements, we use ground-based radars and optical telescopes, as well as in situ measurement, meaning experiments or surfaces we expose to the space environment and then brought back here. So we use those data to better understand the orbital debris populations from very big to very small. And once we have the measurements, we build models to describe the environment, to predict the impact risk to satellites, to critical assets such as International Space Station, and to better understand the outcome of an orbital debris impact, we conduct a laboratory-based hypervelocity impact tests to assess the damage of a hypervelocity impact. And then based on that, we can develop impact shields, and then we can put on critical satellites to protect them from being impacted by small orbital debris. And at the same time, we work with various U.S. government departments and agencies, as well as international space agencies, to come up with guidelines to try to better manage the environment, to mitigate the orbital debris problem, to try to protect the environment, to preserve the environment for future space operations. So a day at NASA is just not all of the above, from measurement, modeling, impact protection, to working with our partners at national and international levels to address the orbital debris guidelines and mitigation issues.
All right, that sounds like a busy day.
Well, it is.
Well, thank you, Dr. Liu, for your time. It was very informative.
That's Grady Montalvo talking to J.C. Liu of the NASA Orbital Debris Program Office at the Johnson Space Center. Grady graduated this summer after spending her senior year at Hartford's Journalism and Media Academy Magnet School, satellite campus at the CPBN Learning Lab. There she worked with our executive producer, Katie Talarski, and a group of other talented students on a podcast called Blue Mic Radio, which you can find at bluemicradio.tumblr.com. This podcast was part of an American Graduate Let's Make It Happen project, funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Where We Live is produced by Katie Tolarski with Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. I'm John Dankosky. Have a great weekend.